All right. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Space on WDRT. We are here this week again with Paul Rattay, the skeptical naturopath. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm Christina DeRocher. Thank you. I'm supposed to introduce myself.
Don't forget.
So we have as our episode theme today, shiny and new.
Shiny and new. I mean, if this isn't all the popular diets in the world, I don't know what it is.
The latest and greatest.
The latest, greatest. This is going to save the world. It's going to save my health. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to get energy. I'm going to cure my autoimmune disease. My cancer will be gone. Everything will happen.
And it will be based on the newest and the best science.
The newest. Yeah, of course. Of course. We need some science to sell it, right? There's some science that lurks behind that. And I think that the popular diets are just a reflection of that, I don't know what you call it, cognitive dissonance or the disagreement that happens in the literature. I mean, if you actually look at the nutritional research, you'll find it's all over the board. We don't have any firm, definite, here's what it is. Here's the diet. Here's what, you know, the government should tell us what to do because this is how everybody should eat.
And why is that? Can't science prescribe the perfect diet? Why or why not?
So why can't science? So the thing is, we need to test it. So science is based on running an experiment. So we run an experiment. And in nutrition land, or actually in research land, it's the randomized controlled trial. We take two groups of people and we give one group, we intervene with one group, and we don't intervene with the other, or we offer them a placebo, or we do something along those lines. So the RCT. And this is this type of research or this type of approach been around since maybe World War II and really beneficial for testing drugs. So you give a drug or you give a placebo and you see what happens. Now, understand that drugs tend to be really strong, right? They really alter your physiology or chemistry. And we may see some effects from that relatively quickly or potentially adverse effects from that too. We can run that with a supplement trial as well, right? So we can do a supplement and say, oh, well, we'll give you fish oil or we'll give you a placebo and see what happens. The issue with that, from my perspective, is that some of these natural substances don't work like a drug works. So it may be something that you need to be invested in and say, well, do I need to take it for 3 months? Do I need to do this for 10 years? So it becomes a little bit more difficult, right, based on how strong the effect is. When we look at diet, it's the same sort of deal, right? So we want to do an RCT. So we want to run a diet trial and put somebody on a, let's say, a low-carb diet and put somebody else on a low-fat diet. And we need to gather a group of people who are relatively similar based on what we're trying to look at. So similar, same age, same sex, maybe they're, you know, have a risk for cardiovascular disease, whatever that is. So we control the group of people that we're going to randomize. And then we randomize them and put them in one diet group or the other diet group. The problem is you can't blind people to a diet, first of all.
What does that mean?
Blind means you don't know what diet you're following.
They will know.
Well, unless I make some kind of slurry and give it to you and you can't tell how much fat or protein or carbohydrates in it because you can't taste it.
It doesn't sound very nice.
There's no way that you're blinded.
Right.
Now, we could put you in a you know, hospital ward and watch you and measure all the food that you eat and do it this way. That's really expensive, and that doesn't really represent real life. But it does represent that we can control as much as we can control. But for the most part, how long are you going to do that? How long are you going to have a hospital ward study? And there's been some clever studies where they'll take people that are living in, you know, in the hospital or in group homes or something. So they're already there and they can kind of manage that and control that. But for the most part, it's going to be free living.
And so going back to the fact that they are not blind to what you're doing, right? What difference does that make on the results?
Okay, so we'll get there.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So we put people in a group. So let's say they're on a low-fat diet or they're on a low-carbohydrate diet. And they know what diet they're on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, okay, well, we have to get you on a low-fat diet or a low-carb diet. What does that mean? So low-fat diet, does that mean 10% of your calories is fat? Does it mean 20% of your calories is fat? Does it mean 27% of your calories is fat, right? So understand low fat is, you know, anything lower than 34% would be considered low fat by the by the rules of American diet. Same thing with carbohydrates. Like, how low do we go? If you're at, 40% carbohydrate, that's going to be considered a low carbohydrate diet. Not ketogenic. Ketogenic would be, less than 5%.
Wow.
Or you go carnivore diet where it's like zero.
I didn't realize that the gap was so big.
Well,
that even 40% carbohydrates is low carb, but then keto and, of course, carnivore are between 0 and 5%.
Yeah, typically. I mean, the standard American diet has about 50, 55% carbohydrate in it. So anything below that, the standard American diet is about 35% fat, 15% protein, 50% carbohydrate, give or take a few on that.
Interesting. Okay.
And so then anything below 50% would be considered low carb. Anything below 35%, 34% would be considered low fat. So we're not being definitive with our numbers. With what we say.
Yeah.
This is just like saying, we blame sugar for things. So sugar to me is, do you mean glucose or do you mean sucrose or do you mean fructose? Like, that makes a big difference. But in the popular world or where whatever we hear, we just hear a low carb, we hear low fat, we say sugar is the bad guy. But, what do we mean specifically? Because if you talk to a chemist, they want to know the specifics of it. Blood sugar doesn't mean anything. Blood glucose does. But regardless, so we have people in a diet, so we're doing this trial, and then we have to quote-unquote train them or give them the diet that they're going to follow, right? And say, this is what you need to follow. These are the rules of the game. And again, are we going less than 5% is carbohydrates? Are we going to 20% carbohydrates? Are we going to 30% carbohydrates? And I'll tell you from personal experience that eating less than 5% carbohydrate and eating 25% carbohydrate, that's a big difference.
I would imagine.
And as far as, somebody being, I don't know that happy is the right word, or being more compliant, it's easier to be compliant with some variation,
Because the word that comes to mind for me is satiety.
Yeah, correct.
Oh my goodness, I don't think I could survive on 0 to 5% carbohydrates. I love rice.
So we've got the two groups. We train them, or we say, this is the diet you're going to follow. And we're going to do this diet trial for, let's say, 6 months or maybe a year. Maybe it's a weight loss trial. Maybe it's whatever outcome that we're looking at. But oftentimes it's weight loss. So we let them go and we may check in with them. So the researchers will check in with them. And we also want to know, so are you following the diet? Right?
Yeah, to what degree are you straying because it doesn't feel good?
And how do we know whether you're straying or not?
I would think they would be honest.
You would think they would be honest. So the thing is, if you're blinded, if you don't know what diet you're under, you may be potentially more truthful. Now, I'm generalizing here, of course, because you don't know what diet you're following.
Sure.
So they say, what did you eat? Here's what I did. But, I drank the slurry and it didn't make any difference because I'm just on this liquid diet that you give to me. Now, there are some diet trials where they've done that, where we give you the food.
Yeah.
We give you the food to eat because we want to make sure you're doing, you're following the rules, and how much can we either entice you or get you to follow something.
Yeah.
Control that as much as possible.
Right.
So we have the low fat, we have the low carb group, and then we ask you. So we check in at 3 months. And maybe we draw some blood and we take your weight and we do your BMI, body mass index, we take your waist circumference, we measure all sorts of things, right? Blood pressure, cholesterol, these kinds of things. And then we say, well, so what have you been eating? And we can do it a couple of ways. They do a food frequency questionnaire, FFQ, which...
How often did
Yeah, in the last 3 months, how many times did you eat chicken with the skin on it or something? So they're trying to get some global perspective of how much of what you eat. Now, the thing is, very interesting, the epidemiologist that designed that questionnaire, she said that it's misused. It's misused because we use a food frequency questionnaire and then we make a determination of how many calories you ate based on how you answered the FFQ. The bigger issue is it's not a really good tool to determine how many calories you eat. It's a better tool to kind of put you in perspective. So if I'm comparing you to somebody else, that probably if you report that you're doing this and somebody else reports that maybe your diet is lower in fat than somebody else's.
Right.
But when we start to say, well, we think your diet was 38% fat or what have you, now it's not really a good appropriate use of the FFQ.
Because wouldn't you need to have a real food journal with, I mean, almost ounces weighed of what you're
yes.
eating in order to really truly say this is the caloric intake?
That's why I like accountants. Yes, accountants. So accountants, so keep track of your diet. People come to see me and say, well, what should I eat? Well, I don't know. What are you eating right now? Let's look at that. And they'll say, well, here's kind of what I'm eating right now. And they'll tell me. Maybe they write it down. But accountants, you give them a tool and you say, well, I want you to keep track of this.
We love that. We make a little chart.
For sure.
Yeah.
And the best ones, you know, I've got this poster presentation from an accountant patient that I had. And she actually tracked her diet for a month before she did the 2-week low carb.
Love
then
it.
Then she did the low carb.
Because then there's a comparison.
Yes, and then she did it afterwards too for a month later. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is gold.
Right.
But the problem is I don't just see accountants.
Right.
I see artists. And the artists come in, so what do you eat? Well, I don't know. Can I draw you a picture?
Right.
Well, yeah, you can draw me a picture, but that's not really hard data.
Right.
And I mean, I kind of think like that. Like, I want as much hard data as I can get, so I somewhat think like a researcher is there. But how do you apply the research measuring things to somebody that's like, well, I'm not sure what I ate.
Right, because if you asked me in the last 3 months how many times have you had chicken with the skin on, if I did eat chicken without the skin on, which I don't, you know, I can't imagine being able to parse out in my mind how many times over 90 days. That's so much time. So
right.
even us accountant types, if we don't have a framework to put things in, I can imagine how loosey-goosey it becomes toward the end.
Yeah, we're trying to approximate it. It's not a bad tool. It's not just a tool that we can say what's 100%. And this is a big deal in nutrition land or research land, is we need things that are measurable, right? So we can measure your weight, we can measure your blood pressure, we can measure your cholesterol, we can measure your waist circumference, but perhaps the things that are really important are not measurable. Like,
oh,
what do you think
say
would be
that again.
So
perhaps the
most important things to us are things that we can't measure.
Such as, how do you feel? How do you wake up in the morning? When you're running, do you feel like you're going to fall apart, or do you feel like you're on top of the world?
Are you hungry? How's your energy? So how do I measure your energy?
Mm.
So somebody comes in and they say, well, I'm tired. And due diligence as a doctor, that we want to rule out things. So if you come in tired, we say, well, we want to make sure you're not anemic. So let's run a blood panel, and we'll look to see a CBC and see if there's, you know, perhaps B vitamin deficiency or iron deficiency. So we want to rule out anemia, which is a big deal. Yes, that would lead to fatigue.
Right.
We also want to rule out thyroid issues. So let's measure your thyroid and make sure that, you know, your thermostat is working properly, and that we can gather that and we can measure that. So we say, oh, well, you don't have a thyroid disease, you don't have anemia. Well, I'm still tired. Oh, well, maybe it's just depression, right? Maybe we'll give you an antidepressant. I don't know, right? But understand that when we don't know we don't know how to put it in a box, then we say, well, what could we do? What is a tool that I have that may help that? But anyways, so those are things that we can measure, right? And this gets into conventional medicine, that we want to make a diagnosis, right? Conventional medicine's excellent at making diagnoses.
Specifically ruling things out.
Yeah,
even if they can't make a diagnosis, they're really great at ruling things out.
Exactly. You go to the ER, they want to know that this is happening or this isn't happening, right? This is what they do. But this is the system that we have, right? We're trying to look at disease, or we think of health as kind of the absence of disease.
That's interesting, because I know that you've said before we want to go toward health, not just away from disease.
Correct.
So this is where they have a blind spot, so to speak,
yeah.
Maybe.
So not having a disease is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but that still doesn't maybe tell me about your quality of life, right? Or these immeasurables. So fatigue, how do I know So if it's not anemia and it's not thyroid, then what do? And in my world, we say, oh, it's your adrenals, it's stress. And that gets into this sort of gray area of like, is there something such as adrenal fatigue? I mean, go online, take a questionnaire. Wow, I have adrenal fatigue. Pretty much everybody has adrenal fatigue.
To some degree.
So it's not specific, but in complementary alternative medicine world, we love that because we say, oh, well, look, it's not anemia and it's not thyroid. It's your adrenals. Your adrenals are exhausted. And I have my endocrinologist friend, and if I say adrenal fatigue and she's around, I look at her, I can tell you her blood pressure goes up like 10 points. She's like, Paul, it doesn't exist. Yeah, it doesn't exist as a diagnostic criteria, but it's this kind of loosey-goosey kind of, maybe that's some explanation of what's going on, but we really don't have a way to go measure it, but it seems maybe, and it quote-unquote makes sense, right? So we make sense of something, but we don't have any hard data to give us some proof on that.
Right.
Anyways, this gets into the whole, can it be measured? Can it not be measured? Or is it immeasurable? And I'm going to still argue those immeasurables are far more important in our quality of life. What's your energy level? What's your activity level? What's the quality of your sleep?
And that's why people say, even if you look great, you may not be healthy, right? Because your adrenals, I mean, not your adrenals, your thyroid, your blood pressure, all of those things, and you're not overweight, and you know your BMI is within range, but you can still drop dead of a heart attack. You can still be unhealthy. You can still feel bad. Yeah.
So it really gets to the how do you feel part.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in this diet trial now, and we have you come back at 3 months, or maybe it's every month or something, and we're going to measure all these things that we know how to measure, right? Researchers love things they can measure because it's black and white. Your blood pressure was this. Now, understand blood pressure. We could test your blood pressure a half hour later, and it'll be different. And some people see that white coat, and their blood pressure goes up.
Right.
So this is another thing. Blood pressure isn't, you know, tightly managed in the body. It goes kind of all over the board. You're under stress. I hope your blood pressure goes up. But we would hope that it comes back down too, right? So it's very kind of fluid that way. But regardless, we can still measure it. We can take a blood pressure reading. We can, you know, measure these things. And we say, oh, well, this is working or it's not working based on that. And then we want to know, well, how compliant are you on the diet? So we ask you. And so FFQ is one thing. The other thing that pretty much most of the time is being done is a dietary recall. So dietary recall typically is, what did you eat yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
If I asked you that, you probably have a pretty good understanding.
Much more exact.
Yeah, you could tell me that. But still, could you tell me that you add 2 tablespoons of peanut butter or 2 teaspoons of peanut butter?
No, but I will say, as an accountant at heart, I do have an exact number of prunes and an exact number of Brazil nuts every day. I mean, I don't go over these limits because I notice my stool changing over days and things like that. So
yes, so you're more
TMI, but
more aware of that. Yes.
Right, right.
But that may be important. I mean, we talked about cereal earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, my history, I don't know, of eating cereal, like how much cereal did I eat? You see what a serving size of cereal is?
No.
It's like 3/4 of a cup or a cup.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. I mean, back to the Honey Nut Cheerios.
So we eat 3 servings, I do.
6 servings?
Oh, my God.
I mean, I remember as a kid, I would get a box of cereal and a half a gallon of milk, and I would eat it all at one time. I used to work at an ice cream place, and we'd go out at like midnight after we were done. We'd go to it was Rainbow Foods in the Twin Cities. We'd go because they're open 24 hours. We would go, we would buy cereal. He'd buy one, I'd buy one. We'd split the milk, and then we kind of go off each other's, right? I could have some of his cereal or not. We'd sit in the parking lot and just eat an entire box of cereal.
Now, if I were your parent, I would be so proud of you, though, because you just told me that you did that and you worked at an ice cream place.
Yeah,
in other words, you didn't take a pint outside and eat a pint of ice cream.
Well,
I'd still take the cereal.
Well, that was being eaten while we were there and on break, right? But we didn't have cereal on that. I suppose now they have ice cream with cereal. We'd do cereal, put it on top of it, and then we'd be there. I'd cover it.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening to the Radio Free Space on WDRT. You're listening to Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, the Skeptical Naturopath. All right.
Oh, so we're back in the study.
Yes.
And so we ask you, so I think a better tool is to say, so what did you eat yesterday? And then people say, okay, well, here's what I ate. Now, if you're on a diet and you know what diet you're on, let's say you're on a low-fat diet, are you going to be truthful about something if you happened to eat some fat yesterday or you had some chocolate cake or whatever it is?
Indeed.
And I'm not saying that you're deliberately untruthful or not, but understand we're not robots.
Right. And you know the game and you want to be, you know, I think people sometimes have this desire to please others or to be compliant, you know, to follow the rules. I personally would be more apt to tell the truth because I like to see what happens. You know, it's like when you put in your astrology online, I'm calling my mom and saying, "Mom, what minute was I born?" Because I want that astrology chart to be so exacting. And so I actually probably would err on the side of saying, "Look, I did have a pint of ice cream. I just, after, you know, 6 days of very low fat, I really, you know, needed to up the ante again." But I do think that by and large, people would probably, and again, like you say, they don't have an ulterior motive
No.
in the back of their mind. They just know the game and they want to play it well and they don't want to look like they, and certainly they don't want to be kicked off the island either.
Right. And researchers will be, please just tell us the truth. We're not judging you. It's not about that. We're trying to collect data in order to make, you know, in order to further science.
In fact, the data would be helpful to know that it's really hard to stay on the diet. That would be really important information too. I can't do this.
I think the numbers are that we tend to lie by like 17%. I can't remember. Somewhere around that. And so some researchers will actually correct their data.
17% or so.
To try to say, but again, it's going to be all over the board, right? Some people probably lie more. Some people lie less. I don't know. And again, it's not the deliberate lie, but you're already potentially influenced because you know what you're supposed to be doing, and then you have to report on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we're not robots, and this is just the reality of the situation, that we're not necessarily good reporters of what we do either. And understand, I mean, what influences our diet? And did I catch you on the right day, right? Maybe on yesterday it was a good day, but are there good days and bad days?
Absolutely.
Did I catch you after a bad day? Did I capture you after a good day?
Or a birthday party, or
somebody
passing away, or a trip?
And some researchers will be even better, and they'll say, we're going to do this like three times. We're going to just call you on the phone and ask you what you ate yesterday. So we're not even taking just one day what you ate yesterday, but we're going to try to do this over a three-day period in the last 2 weeks and kind of call you unsolicited.
Right.
And just say, so what did you eat yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
And please just be honest, because this is really important for us. But if we were robots, it would work a bit better. But anyways, that's the problem with not being blinded, is that you're going to know that that's an issue, right? This is typical that humans tend to underreport our calories and we overreport our exercise. I mean, you've done those questionnaires, right? Like, how much exercise? Like, is it moderate or is it light? Or, you know, I'm kind of in between. Or, oh, yeah, but if I'm really looking at when I was really good for that week, then I'm going to mark this. But then there was a week that I wasn't so good, and right, that's where you get to they give you the Likert scale and there's five choices on there, that becomes difficult, versus giving you an open-ended question and say, how much exercise did you do and what did you do? But then what do we do with that as a researcher? Then we're going to get what we call qualitative data, right? Qualitative data is messy.
All over the map.
All over the board. And understand, some people are going to interpret things differently than somebody else would interpret that. And we're trying to be clear. It's not that we aren't aware of this. We're just trying to do the best that we can to capture the information. But that's perhaps immeasurable, or that we don't have perfect information with that.
Mm.
Anyway, so we're in this trial, and then we say, well, this diet worked or this diet didn't work. And then what we never really ask when I look at these diet trials, first of all, how long does a diet trial need to be? If we're trying to lose weight, I mean, how long should it be?
I mean... Just a guess out of the ballpark. I mean, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years would be nice. I'd say 20 years.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, really,
right.
We care about, do we do something and can you maintain that for 20 years? But how many people are going to stay in a clinical trial for 20 years? And how many times is your diet going to change over the next 20 years?
Right.
I'm going to follow a new diet. Oh, it's January. My diet's going to change. And then come July, it's going to be completely different again. And again, it's not that it... how much it changes, but we get on a bandwagon and then we get off a bandwagon, or we need to go on a diet, right? And this is, again, the popular diet industry is there to provide you something new and shiny to say, here it is. You've never done this before. This is brand new. This is like groundbreaking science, like cutting edge science that's telling you, here's what you need to follow.
And you just went over how the science, it's almost a lie as well to say that it's cutting edge, because you just can't get that kind of precision. And you certainly can't, even if you could get that kind of precision, you can't look at the person in front of you, which they're not. They're putting a diet book on a shelf and we don't know who's buying it and what their lifestyle is like. But you certainly can't pinpoint the right person for the diet either. Do you know what I mean? Like, how is this right for me? How do I know that this is cutting edge science that actually makes sense in my life as a woman with a child and, you know, living in the Caribbean versus a man with no children, retired, living in, right? I mean, there are all these variables, even without the cutting edge science, which you've just described as being, I don't know, I feel very skeptical myself in this moment. How is it cutting edge?
Yeah, how is it cutting edge? And understand that, how do we know what's perfect for everybody? And perhaps we're trying to get to this point, like we're trying to have this prescription of, like, for example, it's the Mediterranean diet, right? So the Mediterranean diet is the end all be all, and that's what you should follow. And the Mediterranean diet is not a low fat diet. And that's probably the most important part of that. It's the low fat diet. But we've been under sway of the low-fat diet for the last 40, 50 years or so. And it's not so much that I think the low-fat diet is wrong. It just doesn't capture everything. Because if we start blaming fat, now we've demonized a macronutrient, but that means now carbohydrates are good guys, right? There's good guy, bad guy. Mm-hmm. Bad fat, good carb. Now we've gone, you know, completely 360. Now it's to the point, bad carb, good fat. Like, we were all wrong for the last 50 years, and now you should go out and eat a bunch of fat. Perhaps the problem, the issue was, we shouldn't be demonizing fat, but we try to look at what really is, what at the core of it is the problem. Because humans have been eating a mixed diet forever, and it would somewhat be based on where you lived and also the time of the year. Perhaps you're eating more fruit in summer or fall, because that's when the fruit is available to you. And again, maybe you figure out how to dry it and do other things, but when you have the food available, you eat it. When the food's not available, you eat something else. And we have to be able to kind of withstand this fluctuations in our food supply, fluctuations if there's a famine, like, what are we gonna do? And again, humans, very, very adaptive at that. We can adapt to eating a meat-based diet, we can adapt to eating a plant-based diet. But then we try to say, well, which one's right? And which one's right for everyone? So it's a blanket statement. So everybody should be on a Mediterranean diet. So what's the issues with the Mediterranean diet?
I would think...
Are there any issues
with
it?
I tend to
think it's quote-unquote perfect, but...
You said it's higher in fat. Is it also higher relatively in carbohydrates? Because when I think of Mediterranean, I think of pasta.
Yeah, for sure. It depends now where you're looking. Like, what Mediterranean culture are we looking at?
Oh, and you, right.
So the origination of that was Crete and Corfu, so the islands off Greece. And this was in the 50s. It's actually Ansel Keys was one of the first ones to kind of characterize this. But it was the Crete and Corfu diet. So what happened on these islands? And they didn't have like immediate access to the same food that Greece did.
By virtue of being an island.
Being an island. It was harder back in the 50s. Now it doesn't make any difference. But you can characterize their diet and we can say, well, here's things that we see in that. But anyways, if we want to sort of characterize an entire sort of half of a continent and say, here's what they ate, we would say, oh, it's olive oil. And it's red wine, and it's pasta, and it's fish.
And it's tomatoes in season.
It's tomatoes,
and it's basil, yes. Fresh basil.
Yes, yes. So, and again, I think there's value there. But understand, so we're in America, and we're going to go on a Mediterranean diet. What does that mean? What's really not in the Mediterranean diet? What there isn't a lot of compared to what's a lot of in the United States?
Root vegetables.
Root vegetables, yeah, I think so. What else? So fat source. So the fat source is olive oil. What did we use as a fat source in the United States 200 years ago?
Beef tallow.
Did we use olive oil?
I don't Did we?
Where do olives grow in the United States?
In the South, I would think.
California. The Mediterranean, yes, right? Mediterranean, yes. Climate.
Right,
I would say there's not a lot of land where we grow a lot of grapes and we grow olives. Right. I mean, again, that's cultural. That's geography that's determining that.
Right. There's nothing bad about it. But
no, there's nothing bad about it.
It's true that there isn't a tit for tat from there to here.
Exactly. So what did we do in the United States? We came over and we didn't eat like the Native Americans ate. We brought cows with us.
Right. Right?
Cows and animals, larger animals,
butter,
this kind of thing.
Milk.
Butter, milk. And it took off, right? We can, cows thrive here. But they weren't, the Native Americans didn't drink milk. The cows weren't here. But anyway, so that's again how we've adapted, or we use the geography to our advantage. And then our fat source is going to be different, but then we're eating butter, we're drinking milk, we're eating these things, which is going to be higher in saturated fat. Olive oil, not much saturated fat, it's monounsaturated, right? So that's considered healthy, where saturated fat is unhealthy. And again, we're making global statements here.
Right.
But yet we've been living on butter and cream and milk for a long time, right? Ever since we've, you know, been in the United States, right? The birth of America, I would say dairy is a huge deal here.
Indeed.
Right? But anyway, so now we're getting away from this. We say, well, you have to be on olive oil. So where do you get olive oil? Where's your olive oil coming from?
Italy.
It's imported,
yeah.
Yes? I mean, some of it can come from California, but for the most part, are we going to supply all the olive oil we need? But if we're going to live in Italy, then we have olives all around us. We're going to have olives. We're going to have olive oil. And olive oil, you can easily process that. You get to make a little screw press, take olives, and you're going to get olive oil from that. So humans have been able to make olive oil for thousands of years. Easy. Tastes good to use it for things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Nothing wrong with it. But somehow that's healthy instead of that's what's provided in our environment. And that's what we use, right? So, but then we get into this lipid hypothesis, and then we start talking about, oh, well, fat's a bad guy, right? Saturated fat's the bad guy. Don't drink whole milk. Drink skim milk. Right? Skim milk? I remember having to switch from whole milk to skim milk.
When?
When I was a kid.
Because your mom got on the bandwagon.
Oh, my gosh, are you kidding me? It's the, you know, I can't believe it's not butter or butter butts. Sorry, it's butter butts.
Right,
I mean, this was the deal. We switched from whole milk to skim milk.
My family never did that.
You never switched.
No, but I grew up in Wisconsin. Did you?
Minnesota.
Okay, yeah. I don't know. Somehow.
But when you drink skim milk and you haven't drunk skim milk before, it's blue.
Yeah.
If you look at it, there's like this blue tinge on it.
And
you're like, oh my God, I'm drinking water.
It's thin.
Now, you eventually adapt to that. And then you're drinking skim milk and then you go to whole milk and you're like, oh my gosh, it's just cream. It's just like all this fat in there. But again, how long have we, as humans, been drinking skim milk?
We have to do something to it, right?
We have to take the cream out, right?
So I can't imagine that.
Why would you do that? Well, I mean, maybe
thinking
it was
of
a
Heidi
leftover
in the mountains with goats and thinking, yeah, did she drink goat milk? I don't think so.
Maybe they had butter and they had some leftover from that, and it was somewhat skimmed, and you would drink that, or maybe you gave it to the dogs, or I don't know, right? I mean, I'm kind of guessing there, but
sure. But
routinely, that's not what we did,
right? By and large, we took the product as it was, and didn't really do a lot of manhandling of food back in the day, so to speak.
No, and it was fresh. You had to consume it fresh, and you have a cow, and you're good to go. I think of Jack and the Beanstalk, right? Milky White.
Right.
They have their cow that provides everything that they need, and they don't have to kill the cow. Right?
Yes.
So this is the aspect that the cow is providing me nutrition. As long as I'm feeding the cow and taking care of the cow, that's a valuable resource. But as soon as you butcher the cow, now we've lost our milk source.
Indeed.
Okay, very interesting.
Hmm.
Anyway, so that's the Mediterranean diet. And so is that really applicable to the United States? It's different. And it's, again, saying that, hey, it kind of fits because we're not eating saturated fat. It's lower in saturated fat, but it's higher in fat, but it's high in fat, but the kind of fat makes a difference.
Now, could you say that maybe it's appropriate to eat that way if we're becoming more and more technologically advanced and less physically active, that it would be important because we do have the capability of essentially importing the Mediterranean diet. We can import the olives, we can import the olive oil, we can grow the tomatoes, we can grow the basil. you know, we can make the pasta or we can import the pasta. And so the fact that we have this capability and the fact that we're becoming, because I always think of, I guess I'm telling you how I'm thinking about food all the time, as a foil to activity or you know, a process of fueling activity. To me, food doesn't go without your activity level. I eat less when I'm less active. I eat more when I'm more active. I eat less the older I get because, of course, I'm becoming theoretically less active. My children are growing and moving out of the house, that sort of thing. So is there ever a time when we should, do you think, import, so to speak, a diet based on our activity level? The fact that, because if it is less in saturated fat, isn't it better for us if we're not as physically active?
I don't know what that means. So the idea is that, how is it that you eat less when you're not physically active? So why does it work that way? Or is that how it's supposed to work? This gets back to the hunger and the energy, right? Why do we eat? Do we eat because we're bored? Do we eat because we're tired? Do we eat because we're with our family? Do we eat because we're stressed? We eat for all of those reasons, and we have the ability to do that in the United States. We've gone through the nutrition transition. What I mean by that, maybe I've said this before, is that we eat in a certain way, and it's been driven by affluence that we have, you know, the financial means to do this, and that creates a lot of choice. So now there's competition for our food dollar. So when we have a dollar to spend, what could we buy with that? We could buy a whole variety of things. And why do I choose to buy this versus choosing to buy that? And this is where the food industry has hijacked everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've hijacked it to make it to be fat, salt, sweet. And that doesn't mean fat, salt, sweet is just bad, but understand the profit-driven motive of the food industry is they want food that has a long shelf life. They want food that's tasty. They want food that's going to entice you. They want food that's going to make their food stand out from another food. I mean, honestly, if you had like five bakers in town and they were all making the same kind of bread and they were homemaking it, you know, they were doing it in their bread oven and this kind of thing, and you had five different choices, what would the difference be from homemade bread from one bakery versus homemade bread from another bakery?
Not much.
I don't think so. I don't know. But you go ahead and put a cinnamon roll there, that's a different story, right? And so you do something to entice that, to say, well, it's not just eating bread, it's actually we're doing something to that.
Mm, right? Mm-hmm.
This is my 1870 issue, right? I think I talked about 1869.
Yes, yes.
So finely milled flour that we can turn into so many different things. It used to be we make bread, right? In Italy, they make pasta, but that's a time, you know, something they've been doing forever. You learned from your grandmother and you continued that process. And it was just not so much was it good or bad, but that was a way that I got nutrition. And that was a way that we're able to convert that into a usable energy pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I mean, it's the work at home to make the bread. And now it's like, who makes bread at home?
Yeah.
Man, I remember I had a bread maker. Do you have one of those bread makers that you just put it in there and it cooks it for you? I don't know. I mean, it was fresh bread, but it's still, I mean, my grandmother, you know, bless her heart, she made bread every day. It was homemade bread. So my grandfather would have homemade bread and soup every day for lunch.
Mm.
And then I don't remember what their dinner was, but that's what I remember. But it was homemade bread. But it was just, this is the routine, right? This is what quote unquote nutrition is. And then, you know, my grandpa gets used to that and then he don't want to stray from that.
Right.
But that's how this is our diet, not saying, well, what kind of bread am I going to have today and what am I going to put on it, or is there other things, versus, hey, I have bread, I have butter, and I have soup.
Thank you so much for listening to the Radio Free Space here on WDRT. This is Christina DeRocher with Paul Rattay, the skeptical naturopath. How long did your grandfather live? How old was he when he passed?
I think 90, 91.
Right. Because every time I hear of an older, you know, older generation, there, by and large, there is a simplicity to it. They come from the land and the time before all of the cookbooks, all of the shiny new things.
Yeah, the shiny new things, the shiny new product. It's a great product. I mean, there's how many different kinds of Doritos in the grocery store. Like, how many different, I mean, why is that? How many different kinds of Coke are there? I mean, how many different ways can
I mean,
they
soda in
that?
General, there has soda to be 40 soda
Again, it's
flavors.
Affluence and choice, right? We it's not like if you're thirsty, drink water. So I would tell my boys, yes, if you're thirsty, drink water. Why are you flavoring your water? What's the point of that? You need water. You don't need
it's
everything
It's a nourishment
else.
Thing, yeah.
It's a nourishment thing.
Yeah.
Anyways, so we've been very distracted from this diet that we put people on, remember?
Right.
So we've got that low carb and we've got that low fat group of people that are following one or the other. And then at the end of a year or the end of 6 months, the researchers will report on it. And they'll report to say this worked better or it didn't work. And they're very motivated by what we call statistical significance, which basically means it's less likely to be due to chance.
Right. They're looking for a significant uptick or downtick in something to say, oh, look what happened. This is significant.
Yeah, and understand significant, they're always, when we refer in research statistics land, it's statistical significance, which isn't necessarily the same as clinical significance. Clinical significance would mean, wow, that makes a difference. Maybe I should do that. So, for example, we could do something where you lower your blood pressure by 2 points. And we could say that's statistically significant because it's less likely due to chance. But we lowered it 2 points. But lowering 2 points, like how clinically significant is that? Like we'd be like, wow, I want to lower like 10 points.
Right.
So understand there's some variation on that, right? So the significance, we want to be clear again that it's statistical significance from the statistical game that you play. Regardless, so we have the trial done, and we report, oh, this diet worked better than this diet. And honestly, I can show you diet trials that show all sorts of different things. Some say this works better, some say that works better, and this is where there's a lot of disagreement, per se, right? But we don't have the end-all, be-all randomized controlled trial that defines it.
Right.
There's no, like, definition to say, oh, this is it. This is a study we did. We now know the answer. We don't have to spend any more money on any more research.
because as you've said, they always end with more research is needed.
More research is needed. It doesn't quite change our opinions, but we need more research to further this. Like, when is there a point that we're like, maybe we don't want to spend any more money on another diet trial to tell us at the end of the day, if we put all the obesity researchers in a room, you ask them their opinion, I think you're going to get a different answer for each person,
mm-hmm.
yes? And they're all going to have their biases, and I mean, we're all biased about their approach and how to do that. But I think what they would all agree upon, it doesn't matter what diet you follow. It's whether you follow the diet. So just find a diet, I don't care what it is, that you can follow. And follow it for 20 years, for 40 years, for 60 years. That's what you need to do. But we don't do that.
Well, you didn't even do that,
right? I didn't do that. Are you kidding me? So it's 6 months, right? Or what's the shelf life of a diet? What's the shelf life of a popular diet? If you're going to follow the latest, greatest thing, what's the shelf life? How long will it last? How long will you be quote unquote good? And understand good may be really aggressive. Again, I'll just speak from a ketogenic perspective. I mean, I get somebody to go keto for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks, but longer than that, good luck.
Yeah, and you're talking about less than 2 months there. I mean, that's not much time at all.
So, but the reality is you need to do this for 20 years. How long are you going to stay on a ketogenic diet?
Yeah, it's pretty intensive.
And you can just see this, right? Carnivore diet too, right? How long will you go just eating meat? And I think you can live without eating meat. Is it healthy? I'm not sure what healthy is, because it's possible what they were doing before they went carnivore was really poor.
And therefore,
or what they did before they went macrobiotic,
mm-hmm.
or before they went vegan, that they made some changes that made a big difference. And it's not about eating the plants. It's not about eating the meat. It's about what they're not eating that maybe has been removed from the diet.
Or what they are eating that they didn't eat for the last 20 years.
Yeah, perhaps. It's for sure that. But understand that my view of the standard American diet, are there lots of obstacles to cure? There's a lot of things that we eat that I think would be best served that we didn't eat them, including those Honey Nut Cheerios.
I was thinking about your examples of vegan and macrobiotic and vegetarian, where they're usually taking something out. And then when they go to ketogenic or when they go to carnivore, they're putting things back in that maybe they had a deficit of some sort, which of course is my story.
Yeah. And then what's a common denominator, right? So did I ask this? I can't remember if we answered this. Like, what is the low-fat diet, the Ornish diet, if we want to use that as an example, and the ketogenic diet, the Atkins diet, as an example, far extremes, right? As mm-hmm. far polar opposite as you can get, what do they have in common?
They're both low carb.
No, they're not. Low fat's not low carb.
Oh, right.
Ornish diet, or the really low fat diet, and the low carb diet. I've asked you this before.
You have, and I can't remember now.
I ask my students this. I can't remember if I've talked about it on this show or not.
I think you have.
I think I have, but maybe we'll just repeat this. What do they have in common?
Wait, is it that what they're taking out, the sugar and the processed food and now I remember.
Yes, right. If you go keto or low carb, you're going to take out sugar by definition. Mm-hmm. You're going to get rid of the bad fats by definition because you're not eating the bad carbs that have the bad fats in them.
Right.
And I would say if you're on an Ornish diet, a low fat diet, okay, you could go out and eat candy, but I'm still going to argue they're really interested in the kind of carbohydrates that you eat are quote unquote whole grain, less processed, that kind of thing. Now we can get into some trouble here when we start talking about whole grains, because I worry more about flour than I worry about
whole grains.
Yeah, whole grain. But the food industry uses whole grains to sell food.
Whole grain Cheerios.
Yeah, whole grain Cheerios.
What?
And you think, oh, I can eat this and I'm healthy, but it's still made with just brown flour instead of white flour.
Right.
And as far as having an effect on your blood sugar, they're the same. Mm-hmm. But stone ground wheat would be different, but that's a bread you're going to have to chew.
Right. It's going to have a different texture.
You'd be like, oh, I don't like that. I want Wonder Bread that I can put in a dough ball and eat it. And then I want my whole wheat bread to be just like the white bread. And so that's what we've got. We've got both are bad.
It's actually hard to find something that is whole wheat completely, even milled, because they often add the white, and it'll say...
Oh, yeah, they'll mix it.
Yeah, and it's got a name that I think it's just wheat flour. If it says whole wheat flour, it's
but still
whole wheat.
Even if it's 100% whole wheat flour, it's still flour.
Right.
It's the flour that I have the issue with. Because flour is refined by definition. It's processed.
So highly processed, yes.
So, but if it's stone ground, that means you took the wheat berry and you ground it with a stone and it's chunky.
Right.
And you're going to cook it and it's not going to completely cook all uniform. But we don't like that. We want uniformity. We want consistency. We want everything to be the same.
We want smooth and we want tasty and we want, for sure.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the movement. Anyways, so we're back to this trial and we report the results. So we see that this diet did better in weight loss, or maybe neither diet worked. But the thing is that the researchers didn't ask the participants, the subjects, what I consider to be the important questions. So the important questions are what? If you're on a diet for 6 months or a diet for 12 months,
how did you feel? Yeah, how did you sleep?
Yeah,
how did you
sleep?
Wake up in the morning?
Yeah, right. I mean, these are things. So what was your energy? Hey, did you feel like you were hungry every day? I mean, if you were starving and you're like, I'm not going to eat that, and you're starving, how long are you going to stay on that diet?
Right.
That's really difficult. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, that may be somewhat that short term and you kind of get over the hump and then you're like, oh, I actually feel better. But still, we never ask that. We never ask. I mean, we kind of ask, you know, how compliant were they on the diet? But we're really not getting into the individual presentation of how people actually did.
The quality, not just the quantity, but
correct.
The quality.
And that's what health is about, from my opinion. It's a personal experience, right? It's an N of one. N of one means there's one person in the trial that we ran. It was you.
Mm-hmm.
And did this work or did this not work? And I may give you a crazy low carbohydrate diet and you come back and you email me in a week and there people will say, oh, I want to strangle you, right? Or I can't sleep at all. I'm like, we went too far. But I know that in a week. I don't need to do this for 6 months.
Yes.
I don't need to do it for 3 years. So perhaps it's about trying to find out what works for you in the short run and then figure out how do you make that work in the long run. And perhaps talking about whether it's plants or animals is the wrong conversation. The question is how is your energy being provided, and is this the right quote-unquote fuel mix for you? And your body's not going to lie to you. But if I'm going to just go based on weight loss or your blood pressure or what have you, then we're getting further away from, but how do you feel?
Quality.
Mm-hmm. Right? 'Cause we could talk about cholesterol all day, and depending on how you look at it, you may report something as really beneficial for cholesterol, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you felt better. Right? There's a big difference between just having a risk factor decrease versus what was my own experience of this.
So diet is more of a philosophy than it is a science.
Yeah, it's a philosophy and somehow guided by, you know, what's available to you. But the philosophy for my grandfather, he didn't have necessarily make a lot of choices. He's just like, I'm used to my bread, I'm used to my soup, I'm used to my nap. Oh my gosh, he was like the crankiest person. He's like, I gotta go to sleep. And I realized, oh my God, I'm just like my grandfather. Like, if I gotta take a nap, I gotta go to sleep. Like, there's no question. My wife's like, you're just gonna take a nap? I'm like, I gotta take a nap, I can't function.
Right.
It's just like my grandfather. Anyways, but so the philosophy is what are you using to guide that? And is your philosophy coming from experts? So I'm going to tell you what to eat. I'm going to be able to tell you what your experience will be. I don't know. Mm. I can say, hey, I have some anecdotal data, and I can tell you I've heard a lot of different things. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories. I mean, I've heard things that I'm like, that doesn't make sense. But somebody tells me that, and then I'm like, oh, well, I just discount it. That couldn't be true.
Though it did.
But maybe it worked for them, yes.
Right.
But I have to be careful that I don't just also take the anecdotal and say, well, that's it. But then we want science to confirm that. But then science is confirming an anecdotal experience of 350 million different people that all have a different experience. They have different levels of stress. They have different relationships. They have a different sleep schedule. They have all these things that may influence that. And then understand that those things may influence what you choose to eat.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Less sleep, poor choices.
Yeah.
Is that
if there's
what you
not
mean?
Fast food around, what are you going to do? You can't eat it, right? I mean, how do you avoid McDonald's? You just drive some way that you don't go buy it, or you put food in your car so that you're like, oh, I'm hungry. Oh, I'm going to have some nuts that I have that I brought with me because that's what it's here for. Because you see the red and the yellow, boom, off, up goes your appetite.
Indeed.
And they know that. So there you go. So we do all these trials, and the important questions or the important experience of the individuals is never really recorded. They don't ask those qualitative questions because we don't know how to measure that. We don't know how to put that together to say, oh, that was statistically significant. We just care, did you lose weight? And it's really not rocket science to get somebody to lose weight in the short term. What's rocket science is to figure out how to keep that weight off for 20, 30, 40 years. What are you going to do? How aggressive do you need to be with your diet? And people will say, oh, I want to lose weight. Got to get into that dress for the wedding. Yeah, but then what happens at the wedding? Then do you just go back to what you were doing before? Probably your diet isn't serving you right now. So now you want to be the quick change. You want the quick fix. But maybe we really need the weight loss over 20 years. So maybe give me the 20-year plan to get you in the diet. So if I can tell you that that wedding is in 20 years from now, let's work for that.
Right.
And so you lose weight slowly, gradually, consistently over time, and then you never gain that weight back. But the whole weight cycling or yo-yo dieting we talk about is that people lose the weight, they gain the weight. They lose the weight, they gain the weight. And what we've seen is that's actually not good for you, metabolically speaking, to gain the weight, lose the weight, gain the weight, lose the weight. Yeah, you're going to these extremes. And the diets that are being peddled are trying to give us a solution because we're looking for the quick fix. We're looking for something because I don't feel good. And I know my diet has something to do about it. I just don't know what to do. In other words, just paying attention to, well, I'm only going to eat what grows in my yard and what I can buy within a five-mile radius of where I live, which is what would have happened 150 years ago. And we've completely separate from that. We have food that's being processed, that's being made in a factory, and, you know, it's got a long shelf life, right? The burger that sits there for 10 years and it doesn't change.
Right. And neither one of us sitting here at this table actually only eat, though, what's in season and what's within a five mile. That's, my goodness. I mean, Macrobiotics used to say 500, I think.
Was it 500 miles?
Yeah. 5 miles is,
and 5 miles is even
your
tougher.
Neighbor.
Who's the woman that did this? I think it's Barbara Kingsolver wrote a book on this.
Uh-huh.
In Seattle or somewhere out, maybe in Washington State.
Living on
somewhere.
A farm.
Yeah, yes. Trying to get everything sourced within a, you know, tight radius.
Right, right.
But that's what we would have done. I mean, that's what we used to do. And then it was a luxury for us to get oranges in the winter because they were shipped from Florida, put on a train. But who ate a banana back then?
Right. And
now
salt,
you eat bananas all the time.
Salt and seaweed and spices, those are all things that we typically don't think about, that we still import, that, you know, we're not.
I mean, the spice trade, right? Big, huge deal in Europe and in Asia, right? How do you deliver those spices? Because now you've got food that actually has some flavor to it.
Indeed. And you can keep it for longer, right? You can pickle it.
Preservation.
Yeah, right.
So there's all those aspects, but we've gone further and further, right? We don't stop as humans. We keep pushing. Like, how do we push? And then we potentially go too far.
So I see here on our docket that we won't be able to get to today, your diet journey.
I keep avoiding it.
Yes,
see, that's,
you
that's
are. The- you are avoiding it. So we have a couple minutes left. I just wanted to say thank you again to all the listeners. I don't know if you have anything, one last thing to add.
Should we end it there?
Okay, but I do want to note, as all of you out there in the listening land, as my witness, that he does have my diet journey, and I'm very interested in hearing you.
Should I tell you the diet journey? So I'll give you just
No, we don't have time for it right now.
Just list them out.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
I'll just list what's on my little sheet here. So I started with a low-fat diet, then I went to an elimination diet, then I was on a vegan diet, then I followed the blood type diet, then a detoxification diet, then a glycemic index, glycemic low diet. Then I found the Weston Price Foundation. Then it was the ketogenic diet. Then intermittent fasting. And finally, this protein leverage hypothesis.
Oh, I can't wait to dig into that next time. Now we have it. You're listening to Christina DeRocher and Paul Rattay, The Skeptical Naturopath. Thank you so much. Radio Free Space on WDRT.